From Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. We are expecting to hear from Governor Gavin Newsom that all California beaches and state parks in the state will be closed as of tomorrow, May 1st. We've not independently confirmed this, but reference to it is made in a notification that was sent by the California Police Chiefs Association to its members. The governor will hold his daily press briefing at noon today, and we will carry it live here on Cap Radio. We are still hearing from you about my conversation yesterday with California Congressman Tom McClintock. I want to first of all thank you for the immense amount of feedback and the engagement. It is quite a measure of to what degree all of you are watching the news, staying informed, and wanting to converse about what is real and true in this process. We have fact-checked some of the congressman's claims about COVID-19. We want to share some of that research with you. So sit back. Here we go through some of these. The congressman said it takes about 25 days from the time of infection until death in the small percentage of fatalities from this disease. So we focused on that number 25. I first of all asked his office for the source of that number, and I was sent a few links, including one to a study by Verity in Hubei, China, that shows an average number of days from the first symptom to death being 17.8 days. Another link was to news that Johns Hopkins on March 9th published their findings of 5.1 days for the median disease incubation period. So the staffer told me that the office added the 17.8 with 5.1, that equals 22.9, and she said they rounded that up to 25. So that's where that number 25 came from. In our fact-checking, the World Health Organization recently reported that the time between symptom onset and death ranged from about 2 weeks to 8 weeks. So the simple average there would be 5 weeks or 35 days. In that conversation, I was talking with the congressman about timing in the shutdown and then in the spike of cases. So if you look at what the World Health Organization is saying, it does mean deaths could happen as long as 8 weeks or 56 days after the first symptoms. And by the way, all of this is something that many of you pointed out too. So that's a look at that statement. Congressman McClintock also said he thought an April 26th piece by T.J. Rogers in the Wall Street Journal concluded something similar to a Tel Aviv study that he talked to us about, that there was no statistical difference in the course of the virus in places where economies were shut down, that the virus just runs its course. So we looked at that Wall Street Journal article. And in fact, it's an opinion piece by T.J. Rogers, who was the founding CEO of Cypress Semiconductor Corporation. And the data in Rogers' piece shows that there is no correlation between shutdowns and lower death rates. However, it does say that in places like New York, where there is a higher population density, the shutdown possibly helped curb the spread of COVID-19 and then lower the death rate. I'm looking at that article in front of me. There is much more to it. I think it's best if we post a link to the article. T.J. Rogers suggests not blindly copying New York in shutting down completely for the rural areas. He said they did count deaths per million population for a fixed 21-day period. Again, we'll share that article with you. Congressman McClintock cited a number of studies and statistics throughout the conversation, including that alcohol consumption has increased by 55%. Well, we found multiple sources that said that retail sales of alcohol are up 55%, and that is attributed in part to bars and restaurants being closed. We did not find anything that cited that alcohol consumption had increased by 55%. Here's one more of our fact checks, and this is something we heard from so many of you about, a number that many of you challenge. Congressman McClintock said, and I'll read the quote here, "The flu killed 80,000 Americans last year, according to the CDC. So I first of all reached out to his office, and they provided me with a link to an article from September 26, 2018. It was in statnews.com, a Boston Globe media partner, and it quotes Dr. Robert Redfield, the director of the CDC, about the flu. At that time, at an event in New York, he told the Associated Press, quote, "I'd like to see more people get vaccinated." And he added, "We lost 80,000 people last year to the flu." So we have no way to confirm or give context to that conversation or that number at the time, but we did look at current estimated CDC statistics for the flu. And in that particular season, 2017 to 2018, it shows the total recently or updated estimated U.S. deaths at 61,099. The year before, it was 38,230. The year after that year, it was 34,157. However, I do want to note that this flu season actually looks like it's going to be a little higher. The estimate right now from October 1st of 2019 through April 4th of this month of 2020 is that there will be the 24,000 to 62,000 flu deaths. So in essence, this year could come up even higher than that year. But we did not find currently in their current flu data the number of 80,000. So I do want to, with that, tell you that we're continuing to do some of this fact checking. We will continue to provide links and updates on our website. The point of this is to try to get the information either as correct as is possibly as available or as correctly in context as it was presented, for example, the 80,000 back in 2018. With all this, I do think we got a cue to talk a little bit more about flu versus COVID-19, because what's interesting today is that in the Johns Hopkins tracking, the number of deaths from COVID-19 in the United States, almost to the number, matches that peak number of deaths from the 2017-2018 flu season. We're roughly at 61,000. However, COVID-19 deaths we know are going to surpass that projected number, even the 62,000. So we've asked Dr. Dean Blumberg to join us. He's on the phone. He's chief of pediatric infectious diseases at UC Davis Children's Hospital. Dr. Blumberg, I know you've been standing by listening to all of this. Thanks for joining us, and I'm really interested in your perspective.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here, and I'm happy you're getting the word out.
So let's talk through some of what the perception is out there about flu versus COVID-19, the death rate in particular in this disease, and what you've come to believe now.
You know, I see the comparisons between the two, and I think it's a distracting to me. And so I think, you know, coronavirus is this brand new virus causing excess mortality. People are dying from it and getting ill from it. Flu's been around forever. We're all sort of used to that, and I think we sort of get, sometimes we just get inured to it, that we're going to have a flu season every year. People are going to get the flu. The vaccine works part of the time. It's not the best vaccine that we have out there, but it does help, and that people will die from flu. We're kind of used to that, and we accept that, and coronavirus is brand new. So I think comparing the two is sometimes it's not useful, because they're two completely different infections.
I know you're speaking from the medical side of this. Should the picture of flu and what it's done in this country and how we've managed it be used then in policy decisions that are being made about COVID-19?
Well, I think what we know that influenza is a respiratory virus, and so in that way it's similar, and we know the burden of disease that it does cause. And we've accepted that. We've accepted that, the CDC, the estimates that I've seen is somewhere between 12,000 and 60,000 people are going to die every year. Maybe we shouldn't accept that. You know, maybe we need to be pushing for higher immunization rates, and we shouldn't accept all those deaths every year. You know, that in the U.S., between about 10 and 45 million people get influenza. Every year. But that is something that we do accept. Influenza vaccine is not mandatory. It's recommended. We try to encourage people to get it. But, you know, with a lot of the things we're seeing with coronavirus, they are mandatory, the social distancing, the closing of businesses, et cetera. So we have taken a different approach because it is novel and because everybody is susceptible.
Well, let me flip that around and get your opinion on this. Some people believe that just as we do with the flu, we should just know it's coming and simply live our lives, not shut down our economy, and accept that some of us are going to get it, and in time, we will know how to manage it and cure it.
Yeah, you could do that. That's going to result in millions of deaths, so I believe that that's just very, very cold attitude, and I don't agree with it at all.
How dangerous is COVID-19 then at this point compared to the flu?
Well, we think somewhere between a 0.5% to 4% of people who get COVID-19 will die from it. And so that's why it could lead to millions of deaths in the U.S. And everybody is susceptible to it. You compare that to flu, where some people have been immunized, some people already had the flu and they've recovered. And even in a bad influenza year, we don't get death rates. We don't get the number of deaths compared to what could happen with COVID-19.
On Monday on this program, I talked about antigen testing for COVID-19 along the lines of the way we have these quick tests for flu and for strep throat. What do you know about antigen testing and the number of companies working on it?
And I know that they're being developed. I haven't seen good data about their reliability yet. Obviously, when we have any of these tests roll out, we want to be able to depend on them, and we want to be able to trust the results. Some of them have been reported to have preliminary accuracy of only 80%. Now, 80% is better than 0%, but still, you really wouldn't then trust a test that was negative because you might be missing 20% of the cases. So, you know, to me, that's really not good enough.
Are there more medications, remdesivir being one, more therapies that are emerging and are being tested in the UC Davis health system right now as something that might be effective? There are some indications, Dr. Fauci commented on it overnight, that a drug can work against COVID-19, which alone is a big piece of news in the world right now.
Yeah, so the remdesivir studies, the results that were released yesterday were promising. I mean, they did show about a 30% faster recovery time. And so that's great. What we have not been seeing, though, is more dramatic effects, such as decreased viral shedding and really preventing patients from dying, which is the ultimate goal. So we'd really like to have even better drugs, but we'll take any progress at this point. Even incremental progress is good.
Can you weigh in on this number, the 25 days versus the 2 weeks to 8 weeks versus, you know, whatever other data is available right now in terms of point of infection to people who have lost their lives in the case of COVID-19?
Yeah, so the studies do vary, and so I guess I wouldn't pin it down to an exact number because the initial estimates were from China, and some people were getting into the healthcare system relatively late in the course of their illness. And then there's different estimates from Italy, and then different estimates from the U.S. But it's anywhere from about 2 to 4 weeks from time of first symptom onset to death when that does occur. And obviously, if you have more heroic measures that are occurring in the hospital, you can prolong life, but ultimately the patient may die anyway.
You and I have been working on health-related information for a lot of years, Dr. Blumberg, and I think I'm just going to be very open about this and take whatever answer you give me. But are we focusing on the right things enough of the time? Are we directing people in the right ways that from your healthcare setting you believe are important and will save lives?
I think we're trying. I'll put it that way. I think we're trying very hard to do that, and there's a lot of distractions along the way. There's a lot of science deniers out there. who say things like we should just open up the economy, it's not that bad, it's a hoax or whatever. And, you know, that's not helpful. That's distracting. And that distracts from the message. I think, you know, I'd like to think that we're all good members of the community who want to protect each other by social distancing, et cetera. And yet you have these people who are already against the vaccine. We don't even have a vaccine, and they're already saying that it's dangerous before it even exists. So you can't deny some of this stuff. You can try. You might not want to believe it. But I think that was one of the problems early on with the U.S. response was we didn't test enough. And one of the issues is if you're not testing, you don't know it's there. But that's like walking around with your eyes closed. So we need to have our eyes wide open. We need to get good data. We need to believe the science when it's good science. The junk science, we need to just throw that away and not get distracted by those kind of messages. I mean, you don't have to believe in gravity, but, you know, gravity's there whether you believe it in or not, and the science is there whether you believe it in or not related to COVID-19.
Thank you so much. Take care. Be safe there. I appreciate the conversation.
Great. Thank you.
That's Dr. Dean Blumberg, Chief of Pediatric Infectious Diseases at UC Davis Children's Hospital. There's more regional news about the pandemic. Sacramento County has extended the stay-at-home order until May 22nd, but eased some of the restrictions. That would be in non-contact sports, some elective medical and dental procedures. There are a few more changes, including an okay for food trucks, so you can find more about that new order at capradio.org. We talked to folks in Nevada County earlier this week, and last, it has decided to ease its outdoor recreational activities a bit, the restrictions being loosened. Those changes, though, come with a request for the ongoing physical distancing and sanitizing precautions. We'll post a link to that as well. And the discussion continues about the possibility of the early start to the school year. That was an idea floated by California's governor on Wednesday. California's state superintendent of schools has surprised us by joining us this morning, and we appreciate that Tony Thurmond is on the line. Superintendent Thurmond, thanks so much for joining in this conversation on Insight.
Thank you, Beth. Sorry to surprise you, but it is a pleasure to have the opportunity to be on with you.
It's a pleasure for us, too. So with a few days to absorb this news, what's the reaction been across the state to this idea?
Well, as you can imagine, the reaction has been mixed. I think a lot of people are anxious because opening school in July, as early as late July or early August, sounds pretty fast to a lot of people. In a time when there are a lot of unknowns. But, you know, one thing I know about this governor is that he always sort of pushes the edges. And as he has talked about, if there is a way to safely reopen our schools, that would give us another way to address the kind of equity issues, the learning loss that many of our students are facing. I think he's really speaking to what's on everyone's mind. When can we begin to reopen the state? And our schools. I think the difference between what the governor has said and what some of your previous guests have said is that we can think about reopening now, but we have to do it with safety in mind and meet the conditions that the governor laid out for making sure there's lots of personal protective equipment and ways to keep kids safe in school and staff in school. And I think even though the governor supports some changes around what we can open, he always says, and I agree, people should be wearing masks, they should be maintaining social distancing, washing their hands. And so, yeah, I don't think this is a time for people to sort of say, hey, we're in the clear, but we do need to think about what the future of reopening of our school looks like and to do that safely.
The shutdown period was staggered from district to district, different parts of the state. If an early school year happens or is allowed, do you envision that maybe it goes the same way with districts doing what they can and it's a staggered reopening?
I think it's highly likely. What I've learned through this experience is to expect anything. But one thing I've noticed is that when school districts start doing things, especially the larger districts, other districts tend to follow because parents will say, hey, how come, LA Unified or San Diego or San Francisco or, you know, Sac City, how come these districts are doing making these steps and we're not? And so, but one thing I really want folks to understand is that at the end of the day, the governor is not mandating a sort of one size fits all. He's not mandating that there would be a common start to all schools. In California, school districts exercise local decision-making, and that is how they decide when they start and when they end. And they're going to have to work through their calendar needs. But I think the governor is giving us an aspirational push to say, let's start thinking about the opening, and that, you know, opening earlier accomplishes, you know, as I mentioned, addressing equity issues for our students. It also addresses the needs of many of our parents who, you know, financially need to get back to work. And so that's what I believe our governor is doing. I've launched a task force of all educational stakeholders to kind of go through the many lists of questions that need to be answered as to how it could happen safely. But ultimately, I think our school districts are going to make their own decisions about when they actually open.
Was this a surprise to you? Was the governor's idea and him just speaking it out publicly the way he did this week a surprise?
You know, the governor, if you watch his press conferences, and he gives one daily, you know, his press conference, he's been hinting at the reopening of the state and the school. I believe it was last week that he first indicated his conditions, factors that would be important to be able to safely reopen. He talked a lot about the need for
personal protection. He had not said late July or early August. He'd talked a little bit more about maybe splitting a morning session and afternoon session and different configuration to the school plan. But the early start to July might be speaking to the idea of summer perhaps having a lower virus rate.
You know, I don't know if that's why he said it, but yes, you're correct. And when he made the statement this week, it's the first time I think anyone had heard publicly that school could open as early as late July or early August.
Do you think schools, teachers, students, and families can toggle back and forth the way we're all, again, taking the governor's cue, getting prepared for, that we might be moving along in one direction and then things get ahead of us and we've got to pull back and shut down more? Will that work for a school setting?
I think that really every Californian should be still thinking about what we're doing right now in our schools, and that's distance learning, remote learning. You know, the teacher and the students are in different places. I think the likelihood is that that's how we're going to finish out this school year, and that's what we should continue to focus on. And I want to commend our students, teachers, and parents. They've been doing incredible work in distance learning. My department, the Department of Education, has been doing 3 webinars a week to support teachers on how to deliver the distance learning. And so I think really what we have now are 2 different options to consider. We've been pushing previously to think hard about using some of summer for some programming to address learning loss, you know, some enrichment programs, right? Some kids have missed a lot of days. And distance learning, you know, sometimes it's bumpy to get started. And so that's still an option, and still likely for many districts to do some summer programming. The governor has entered another option, and that is that if school districts can safely reopen, that is another way to very quickly address learning loss, because now teachers can start to assess where students are in terms of the new grade levels that they'd be entering, and do they need additional support to get up to speed on grade level. So I don't think parents are going to have to toggle back and forth. I think we just have to keep doing what we're doing right now, which is distance learning. But right now we have to be planning for what we do in the summer. We have to be planning for what we do when school reopens, whenever that ultimately ends up being.
Well, again, I thank you so much for joining us and continuing to add some clarity to all ideas being on the table at this point. Stay safe. I appreciate the work and cooperation of everybody in your office.
Thank you, and I hope that your listeners will continue to listen to you, and they'll check out the website for the California Department of Education. We provide updates around the clock and daily about what's happening with California schools.
We'll post a link to it, because your webinar information, your other resources are good there, and I appreciate the reminder. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Stay well.
That is our California State Superintendent of Schools, Tony Thurman, joining us. I do want to add a reminder to you right now that, as we mentioned, the McClintock fact-checking, the sources that were used both from his office and for our own look at the data are posted right now on our Insight page. So you can go to capradio.org/insight. There's much more ahead after a short break. Dr. Carolee Tran will reflect on the fall of Saigon 45 years ago today and the gifts that adversity has given her. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio.